This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting windroserecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Elena Olander, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
To Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry. This is The Path to Authenticity. If you haven't checked out the new website yet, it's thepathtoauthenticity.com. There I have a couple blog posts related to this episode's guest. It's an artist living and working in Jacksonville, Florida. Her name is Elena Olander. So if you've followed the show and you have checked out the website, you noticed I've been doing some blog posts where I have a standardized questionnaire that I've been having all the more recent guests complete. And Elena did that and was nice enough to share some of her work. So I have some images of her work on the website as well. So check that out. Be links to her website in those posts and in the show notes. She does some really cool stuff, and she was just very warm and kind and easy to engage. And we had a great conversation. So I hope you enjoy it. Here you go, Elena Olander. You don't sound like someone who grew up in Duluth, Minnesota.
You know, it's very interesting that you mention it. A lot of people ask me this often, and I always stumble over the question because, well, my mother, she's from Norway, born, and she spent probably much time between immigrating to the United States in the 50s. She was born in the 40s. And then up until the 70s, kind of going back and forth from the United States and Norway. And then my father, he is of Chinese descent, but born in the Philippine Islands. And both of them, English is not their native language. So probably it comes somewhere from there, while simultaneously, probably I try to speak as proper English as possible.
I've picked up on that. You're very deliberate in your speech. I've noticed that. Very precise.
I try to be.
Yes, it's good. But so you're saying, so you grew up around what? Probably Tagalog. Is that how you pronounce it? I don't know, but I know.
Yeah, and then, Tagalog. Mm.
And then your mother would have spoken, Norwegian? That's a language, yeah, right?
It is indeed,
and
yeah.
And then English sprinkled in there. Did your dad also speak Chinese or only Tag?
I believe he speaks some Mandarin as well. But I think for the most part, they had a hard enough time speaking English to each other. Okay. So.
Okay. So now did your mom speak Tag or speak Norwegian? How did they communicate?
No. They spoke English to each other in whatever capacity that looks like.
Oh, wow. That had to be interesting.
Yeah. It could be interesting at times. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I mentioned to you before, I've been following you online for a little while now, admiring your work. And why don't you, how do you describe your work? How would you explain it to someone who has never seen it?
Oh, gosh. I suppose I would say that the medium I work in is mixed media illustration. And that's the best way I've been able to describe it. And then typically, a recipient of that information would inquire further.
What might they ask?
What do you mean? Yeah. And then I would say, I suppose it's illustrative figure work that is utilizing different materials to produce an overall image that bridges the gap between a comic book style and fine art.
Mm. So what sort of art do you draw inspiration from? The comic books?
Oh my goodness. Oh, how do I backtrack on the things that inspire me? I suppose outside of comic book style or Japanese manga and animation, those are probably my main influences. There are other artists who have kind of paved the way for the path that I'm currently on in my work. And so some of those would be like Yoshitomo Nara, I think is very illustrative and yet still three-dimensional as well. And so artists like Yoshitomo Nara or Takashi Murakami, for example, I think they're obviously a bit more contemporary, but certainly inspire and inform my aesthetic.
Okay. So when I see it, I see a little touch of graffiti in there too.
Oh.
is that something that you see or something that's influenced you, would you say?
I suppose. I think there was a time in my life where I was young and angsty. They call it teenage years. and I was a bit rebellious, somewhat non-conforming, although I would never admit that I'm non-conforming because it felt like I'd be conforming to some kind of group. I had some friends that were from LA, and I currently reside in Jacksonville, Florida, and did at that time. And they were graffiti artists themselves, and I was fascinated by that process. I don't think I had fully explored my potential as a young artist yet, but I definitely think that street art always fascinated me. Yeah.
Hmm. So when did you first get the bug for art?
I think it's one of those things that's hard to pinpoint. And I say this simply because I don't think I just declared myself an artist. You know, it's like it chose me or something. Mm-hmm. And as a young child, as a catharsis to kind of cope with my environment, it was a bit toxic in so many ways. That was my expression or way to work out any of the feelings and emotions I had. And only later, maybe someone else recognized it. Mm. And they said, hey, you know, you're great at drawing, things that you see, things from your imagination. You know, maybe have you considered taking any courses in such thing? And I really hadn't. There were courses available in, you know, my rudimentary education, but I didn't take them because I think it was very ingrained that being an artist meant being starving, mm-hmm. or it meant, you know, not really having a career. It's something to be a hobby. It wasn't fostered that way. Mm-hmm. And so I thought more practically. I grew up about most of my life was with a single mother, and she was a bit older and didn't have much education or work experience. She had 7 children and spent most of her life raising them. And so I'm kind of the last of the children in terms of age. And so I thought about practicality. Mm. And so, I mean, even at one point I entertained the idea of military life, because that would mean an escape. It would mean a paycheck. It would mean I'm serving my country. But the bug, I think, really hit me when my sister, I have an older sister, she was newly married, but then she got diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's disease. Mm. And it was just she and her husband alone in Kansas, away from majority of family on both sides of their families. And I was kind of the only one who didn't have any specific ties to any one place. I was young enough, you know, 14, 15 years old. And so I moved up there and lived with them. And living in Kansas, I realized that the public education system had a lot of options available to the learners there. And there were all these art classes and foreign language classes that I'd never even seen. Mm. And so my sister encouraged me to take some courses, and I did, and I took them all, everything they had in the time that I stayed there, which was probably about 2 years. And then once she finished her chemotherapy and had been in remission for a long time, I left, and I came back to Jacksonville before I was 17 years old.
Wow. Mm. So you graduated from high school in Jacksonville?
Yes and no. I say no because I never graduated high school.
Okay. There's a story there.
I was a bit turbulent when I came back, and the main reason why I came back to Jacksonville was I was in love with a boy. Mm-hmm. And I, at the time, you know, I was looking at a full scholarship to one of the Kansas colleges for art. And I turned it down to move back to Jacksonville to be with a boy that I love. And he was nothing but trouble for me. But and I'm not totally innocent here.
Oh,
but
takes two, right?
Yes. And I actually got in a car accident with this person. I was a passenger and we were T-boned at 60 miles per hour. And I broke my pelvis in three places and my lung had collapsed and I had, you know, concussion and major, a cut on my forehead. And I think I kind of, it was like a wake up call at 17 years old and all of the kind of, trouble I had been in. And I had to relearn how to walk for about 6 months. And so I didn't graduate high school. I had missed a lot of school. And when I did go, I usually skipped. And so, yeah, I ended up getting kicked out of high school. And but I did get my GED a few years later.
So then what?
After the GED?
After high school, yeah. After, I'm sorry, after not finishing. When you came back to be with the boy and the wreck. And you, well, you mentioned that that was an eye-opener. You know, so what was the message that you got from that?
I think the message was several things. I think it kind of made me realize that the time here is not forever. And what am I doing with my life? Like, what do I want to do? And, but also what am I able to do at this time? You know, like, not having a lot of money or resources or support. I had been working in the service industry already, As a teenager, I think I got my first job at 14 years old, working in different Japanese restaurants. And in that time, after I recovered from the accident, I found myself as an adult, and I found myself trying to get away from family and everything. And I started working again in the restaurants, and very quickly I found myself from what initially was my introverted self saying I only want to work in the back as a dishwasher or a cook or a kitchen aid, quickly moved into, well, you're female and we think that you're better suited to the front of house. And so I became a bartender at 18 years old, and I ended up doing that for 10 years.
Okay. So so that probably brings us just about up to...
just about.
Current, yeah, yeah. Well, so, well, you know, that's... I'm sure you got lots of inspiration from that, right?
Yeah, I think I learned a lot about life, and at 21, I had my daughter, who is now 10, and it changed my perspective also. It was like another wake-up call, like, what am I doing with my life still? And I decided to kind of do things in disarray, and I said, well, I'm going to go to school now. So I did. I had my GED, and I applied for a private college. I didn't have much guidance. I didn't know, you know, I don't have SAT scores. I'm not prepared for this. I just know that I want something more than working in the service industry. I love it, and I think you can make a good living doing it, but it wasn't really serving me or my purpose beyond, you know, survival,
right,
monetarily. So I ended up getting into the Art Institute of Jacksonville, and I went full time for 4 years and got my bachelor's in photography.
Wow.
So I really thought that I would get a degree in painting or something of that nature. But there was that voice in the back of my head still telling me that being a visual artist or a painter, I'm not going to be able to sustain a living and take care of my daughter. So I thought photography is the next best thing to write with light, and I can still shoot commercially while still having some kind of conceptual work that is personal and make a living.
Okay.
And I realized that only after I got a piece of paper and lots of debt, I realized that photography is not my medium.
Okay. Well, you know, it's funny because if you're anything like me, I mean, we get this message in our culture that everything's linear, that you need to finish high school, go to college, get the job, get married, have kids. You know, it's sequential the way things.
Yeah.
And so often we feel like if we're not following the sequence properly, we're doing something wrong, or maybe even there's something wrong with us. And I'm sure your nonlinear process, my process was definitely nonlinear, as it continues to be.
Same.
But I'm sure you wouldn't trade it for anything. Right?
Oh, no.
I mean,
oh, no.
Because we learn the way, you know, we learn from these things and we become who we are, that this is how it happens. And it's kind of beautiful. And one thing I feel like I wish we were better at, and something that I try to remind myself of oftentimes, is to embrace the mystery of it all. Like, we don't have to have all the answers. In a way, it's pretty exciting to not know what's around the next corner, but also have the experience behind us to know that it's going to be exciting and probably much better than we expect. At least that's my experience.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that there are societal expectations, and people may struggle with that non-linear, unpredictable path of life.
Right. Well, it's nonconformist. I mean, people, you know, the status quo gets pretty uncomfortable with that sort of thing. You know, and it's so deeply ingrained in us that, you know, I've gone through periods in life where, I don't know, I decided a couple years ago I would wake up on a Saturday or Sunday morning, having slept a little bit late, feeling bad. And after a while, it was like, you know, I don't have anything to feel bad about. You know, I'm not talking like 3 in the afternoon. I mean, like 9:30 or 10 or.
Oh, yeah, that's not bad.
No, but also, it comes from the messages that I got as a child. Like, you know, get out of that bed. You're not going to sleep the day away at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, you know? and, you know, there really are 24 hours in a day. It doesn't all have to take place between the hours of 9 and 5. I mean, but as a culture, that's how we function. Like, a day is 9 to 5. And that's something that, especially just over the last couple weeks, I've begun to try to challenge within myself, because with this project, this podcast, and everything that goes with it, I could just work around the clock and never be done. I mean, there's so much to do to take this to where I want it to go that I could just work all the time. And it makes me pretty happy to work a lot, but you know, so really, I don't know. I don't know about you, but for me, I'm probably more focused now on trying not to work too much because I love what I'm doing so much that I could just work and work and work, but I know that that's not healthy either. And I need to maybe go outside occasionally or go out into the world. And, you know, I'm a little bit of a homebody and an introvert. So this whole pandemic thing, it hasn't really bothered me all that much. It's beginning to now.
Okay.
I'm ready, but anyway, enough about me. So where are you now in terms of the financial part of it and where you're making a living, and is art sustaining you at this point, or are you still on the road to that? Where are you?
I am 3 years into being a full-time artist.
That's great.
I didn't predict that it would necessarily go as such, but and as far as sustainability, every month to month is different, you know.
Yeah.
It's creative entrepreneurship. I've never worked so much in my life. But it does make me feel fulfilled to express myself, make the work that I create that resonates with others, and maybe inspiring others in some way, either with my journey or my work. And I don't know. It was one of those things where, you know, I worked in the bars for 10 years and I felt like I had really kind of gotten to a breaking point. Like, I got the degree, and the degree is maybe not the path that I will feel serves me. And I'm still finding myself here behind the bar, like, and I love it. I love the interaction with the people. I get to have so many intimate conversations with others in all different times of their lives. And I felt like I learned a lot of wisdom. I mean, beyond drinking probably too much. I learned a lot from others that were willing to share, but maybe some of that wisdom kind of helped propel me that being in that space and doing that for a living wasn't my calling.
Interesting. So the photography, that's out the window.
Yeah, I would say so. I do enjoy conceptual self-portraiture. That's kind of where I found myself in the latter portion of before I kind of set the camera down. I still photograph my daughter like annually a few times per year, probably more, not enough. I mean, I should probably photograph her more for the sake of how quickly time passes.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah, I set the camera down. And once I did, and I set, you know, bartending down, I mean, I just put all of my materials that I had accumulated over the years, as far as, you know, art supplies, and I put it in one space. And I bought a table, and I bought drawers and a shelf, and all of a sudden I had a makeshift home studio, which I had never had before. And after kind of creating that space to invite myself to come in and make work, like, I just didn't stop. And that was, like I said, about 3 years, going on 4 now.
Wow. It's interesting, the space. isn't it? How that affects what we do creatively.
Yeah, I think so. It may be physical space, but I also think it's like a mental space. And together, it can be conducive to this exploration or discovery. And I don't know. It was like an epiphany.
But
also frightening. Frightening risk.
Now, you sent me a couple photos, so I assume the photo of you sitting at the table, that's the table you're talking about, where you set
it
up.
It is.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's a really great picture.
Thank you. Yeah, a friend of mine, Tony, took that picture. He's a phenomenal photographer himself. But I think that what initially was like an 8x8 room ended up taking over like my entire living space. So like sunroom, dining room, living room, and that 8x8 room are now my studio.
Wow. That's great. You're living it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm grateful.
Yeah. And you know, I went through a similar process over the last, well, really, I've been doing a lot with my living space during the pandemic. That's
okay.
And that for me, it's a nesting. That nesting process is a healing process for me. I've noticed, as I was going through my divorce, I did a lot of painting. Decorating, okay. You know, like just like grooming my space. And, and I've done that, you know, I did it after another breakup and it was like just something that just felt like needed to be done and something to do with my energy and also to honor myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, during the pandemic, I've been more kind of in the back of my mind. I mentioned that I write, you know, I want this to look more like a home where a writer lives. And I've kind of focused on that. And I set up this corner in my bedroom where I have a chair where I sit and write every morning. And just like adorned the wall around it with I really turned it into a space where I honor that, you know, that part of myself. And it just feels really good. And I'm drawn to it. It's, you know, it's honoring the creative part of myself, you know? So, yeah, I get it. Now, hopefully I have a burst of, creativity like you have where, you know, you've been working nonstop at that table for 3 years, it sounds like.
Feels a lot of work. Like it. Yeah. Feels like it, yeah.
So what are you doing? I noticed there was a coaster thing that you did, some sort of coaster project thing. What was that all about?
Well, that was very recent. With everything going on this year, I wasn't sure how my sustainability would be. And, I find myself looking for spaces that I could submit my work to. And oftentimes I try to find something that is, fitting with my work. Perhaps maybe, a gallery space shows work that is, in a similar vein. And I would try to give myself as much time as possible to prepare for the submission whenever the deadline is to submit. And this particular gallery is called Gallery 30 South in Pasadena, California, and looks like they have a coaster show every year. And it is the only exhibition that they accept submissions for. So I said, I never painted on coaster before. That could be interesting transition for me, just to kind of like, I don't know, explore something new, maybe find something new. And so I said, yeah, I'm going to submit the maximum amount, which is 10 pieces for this show by the deadline. So I sat down, and probably I began August 15th, so middle of August this year, and I had maybe 2 weeks from that point to submit the work. It is not the only work I was working on at the time, but, you know, sometimes life happens. And, you know, 2 days into making, you know, first coaster out of the 10, I got a phone call in the morning, and it was from my sister, one of them that lives here in town in Jacksonville, and she was in a panic. I could barely understand what is it that she's saying to me. And I finally deciphered that she's telling me my mom, on the way to work, had hit a tree, totaled her car, and was on her way to the hospital. And I was thinking, like, what? You know, like, and I just dropped everything and drove straight to hospital. And on my way to the hospital, I'm calling them to see if they even allow anyone to come in because of COVID restrictions. And, you know, my mom, she's 76, and she had had an episode earlier this year, although she wasn't driving at the time. And so I was also in a panic, but trying to hold it together. And I get to the hospital, and she's just like completely out of it. She has some pretty major injuries, but the first thing when I got into the hospital and finally saw her in the room, she said, "How do I look?" And I said, "Pretty damn good for someone who just hit a tree." And it was emotional. And they ended up transferring her to like trauma center and at a different hospital, which did not accept any visitors. And you know, I still had 2 weeks at this point to submit work, and I had other projects that were, you know, arranged prior to her incident. And I tried to, you know, be her best advocate, outside whatever I could do for her while she's in trauma center, while also burying myself in my work, because that's really all I knew what to do, you know. Thankfully, she's in good recovery. But, you know, when I finally submitted the works, I got an email back, and I wasn't sure I would, you know, this is gallery in LA, and I don't know, you know, like, I never submitted my work out there before.
Right.
And I got the email back, and, gallery owner said, you know, I'm having trouble seeing your files. I'm like, oh, great. You know, like, I did something wrong. But actually I didn't, something was going on their end. And so I resubmitted through another means, and gallery owner wrote back and said, I love them, and I want all 10 in there. And I said, oh my gosh, you know, that's great. And I mean, I was shook to my core, and I immediately sent them out whatever the next like business day was. And then exhibition just closed, and, you know, he kind of sent an email out to all of the participating artists saying, hey, you know, maybe you can, you know, share it on your social media platforms that today is the last day. And that was maybe end of last week, or I mean, very recent. And at that point, it's like, it's California. So maybe 3 to 4 hours behind. Mm-hmm. And, I looked at the clock, I looked at the website, and my work hadn't sold. And I thought, wow, you know, I already have success because they accepted the work in there. That's great. And then, come to find out, all 10 sold. So I cried. I wept. I'm not going to lie.
Well, they're happy tears. Like nice.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, for sure. Like,
and triumphant just, tears.
Right? Yeah, indeed.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I hope I answered your question.
No,
I
know you, of course you did. That was but no, that was great. No, you managed to do it all in spite of some difficult circumstances, and you still like knocked it out of the park. Right? That's pretty cool. Thank you. Yeah. So, and then now I have noticed also how you have, especially since the onset of the pandemic, addressed racist tropes.
Indeed. As well.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I suppose if I backtrack to, I want to say March of this year, but probably maybe end of February. I was working on a project, which was a very large mural with 7 other artists in Jacksonville, Florida. And I was getting to the end of it. We had a month to produce the work, and we kind of had to rotate schedule due to the available, they call them cherry pickers.
Mm-hmm. No, I know what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah. So, we kind of came whenever, each other had a time, and I found myself working on the wall. And when you make public work, which is very new for me, I realized that many passerby would come, and maybe they're from the neighborhood, and they would ask you questions like, "Oh my gosh, this is great!" and "What is this about?" And I'm always happy to come down and chat with anybody who's interested. Mm-hmm. And I was up working one day again. It was toward the end of the project, so getting closer to the March timeframe, and I came down, someone on a bicycle came and yelled up to me, and I had headphones in and I didn't really know exactly what they were saying. So I came down, and a person said to me, "Hey, you're wearing the wrong mask." And I just took a moment to kind of comprehend what they're talking about. I said, "No, I'm not wearing the wrong mask. I'm wearing like aspirator because I'm painting," and they were like, no, you should be wearing an N95 because you might have coronavirus. And it just hit me like, wow, is this racist right now? Like, because I'm Asian and I'm here in public, like I don't know. It took me a moment to process it. Yeah. Like, I
and
think
just
I was
for the
shocked.
Listeners who don't know what a cherry picker is, it's like it's like a platform on wheels with a ladder going up. It's used in construction often to be a stable work sort of workspace to, and you crank it, it moves up and down. So she was up in the air when somebody flagged her down to, right? That's what we're saying. You were,
yeah, that's wow. It. Yeah.
So then what, how'd that play out, that interaction?
More than likely, I said something like, "Well, I do have an N95 mask, and in the appropriate situations, I'll wear it." Like, I just kind of diplomatically moved on and went back about my business to finish working. Mm-hmm. And after that, I finished the project, and then, of course, it was a global pandemic. By the World Health Organization and the CDC. And I just kind of carefully watched and listened. I don't really watch a whole lot of media outlets, because it's hard to process sometimes. And I started to see words like Chinese virus or Kung flu or like Wuhan flu used to describe the coronavirus. And I just thought about it like, wow, you know, that's probably not the best language to use to describe this, you know? Yeah. And then, you know, we fast forward a little bit and I had to go to a grocery store. I was alone that day. My daughter wasn't with me. And I was passing by the entrance of the grocery store to go inside. And as I'm going inside, there is someone at a kiosk to rent DVDs.
Mm-hmm. Well, the red box.
Yeah. And then I'm passing by.
Who rents DVDs anymore?
I don't know. Yeah. I thought everyone's streaming.
The kind of people who would make a racist comment to you about. Right. So,
yes. Anyway,
I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, that you're right. And this person said to me, go back to China. And I just, like, wow, I'm kind of glad my daughter wasn't here for this moment. And I just kept walking. I didn't confront them. There were other people around. No one said anything. And I just started to think about how, if this is happening to me, then I imagine this is happening to others, not just in America, but around the world. And maybe, like me, may not have initially said anything about it, maybe to a close friend or a family member, or maybe they internalize it. And then I started to see some stories coming out, personal stories about being spit on in New York and going home and crying, or like being set on fire or being stabbed in Texas, children and a mother, and all in the name of the Chinese virus. And they may not have been of Chinese descent. They were Asian, but either way, you know, this was happening. And so I started to look at these like crimes against Asians accounts that were popping up, and a database that was created by Dr. Zhang in San Francisco State University to stop AAPI hate. And you could anonymously or not share your experiences with Asian discrimination. So I started taking those very words that were used to place in my work as a way to say that I am not a virus, and to, you know, to put that out there for viewers to see and maybe empathize with, and, you know, be a part of the solution instead of being part of the problem. And I never really thought of myself as like a political artist or artivist or art activist, but I just couldn't not produce the work. I had to.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty powerful stuff. I'm glad you did.
Thank you.
So how was the response to that? What was that like?
I mean, the response was a whole other journey. So most of it was positive reinforcement.
Well, and I think maybe I'm wrong, but I think I saw a post you did a while back about you got some responses from people who may have misunderstood the message, right?
Yes. I had an opportunity through a friend who I was able to speak on the news and like a radio station about this body of work. And it was quite brief of an interview, but I mean, pretty straight to the point. And I was grateful for the opportunity to get the message out there and feel like I'm standing on the right side of history. And I didn't read the comments when the news station posted it on their social media. I received the link separately through an email, and then I shared it. So I never saw the original post, and then people started sharing it with me and saying, "Hey, have you read the comments under this, you know, news broadcast?" And I said, no, I haven't. And I said, why, you know, is there something particular? And then, I mean, I didn't want to fall deep into some kind of rabbit hole, but I read a few, and it was interesting to read many people's response. Some of it was clearly racist, and others were talking about, well, what about China and what this incident that happened at McDonald's there and what they're doing to Africans in their country and all of this, you know. And I did make a response, and I said, you know, that any form of discrimination by or against any people is unacceptable.
Right.
You know, like I'm not condoning what's happening over there. I'm just speaking about my experience personally. So that happened. And then after I shared a piece of the work without the context for it on my social media, I got added to a group, like a vigilante group on Instagram, where they like attacked me. Like I had no chance to even respond. I mean, there were so many people in this group. I was shocked. They were saying, I mean, using pretty nasty words that, I mean, they were against that said "thanks Jinx," which was in response to an individual wearing a mask that said that. But they attacked me, and eventually I was able to get a word in and explained, you know, the body of work and its reaction to what's going on. And they immediately just dropped me, said sorry, and then just dropped me. And so it's been an interesting ride.
Sounds like it. What has that been like from an emotional standpoint to have to go through that?
Gosh, I think for me, I felt that I am doing something right, because it's creating conversation. It's creating reaction. It's taking up space, and maybe it's making people feel uncomfortable, but I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. I remember I wrote something in high school that was in this literary magazine that we did. I was telling a friend of mine about it last week, and it almost got me beat up at one point. You know, it made a big stir.
Okay.
And I remember the teacher saying to me, you know, in all the years I've published this thing, I've never had anybody write anything that got so much attention.
Wow.
You know, and it was like, I mean, it felt like, because, you know, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't attack anybody. It was just me making an observation about human behavior. And it pissed people off. Probably because they were engaging in it.
You know?
And so Or benefiting from it or whatever. I'm being pretty vague, but I don't want to get into a bunch of detail. Anyway, no, I mean that I know that feeling of, I'm obviously not on the magnitude that you're talking about, but yeah, you know, it's like the whole thing that, there's no such thing as bad PR, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if people are talking about it, that's pretty great. So, but on the other hand, what I started to think about, especially when you're mentioning the post that the news station did, because I'm not on Facebook a ton. I really don't like it. I use it to promote the podcast and sometimes as a platform to like express frustration from what I'm seeing in the world. But the local network affiliates, when they post things, man, it gets nasty real quick. It does. Yeah. I mean, the politics, I mean, you have the Trumpers and yeah, I mean, just attack. It's ugly. And Twitter's probably the worst. But are you familiar with Brené Brown?
Brené Brown. I don't think so.
She, I think she describes herself as a shame researcher. She did all this research on shame and vulnerability. Ultimately, it turned into vulnerability. And she did a TED talk that went viral very, very quickly. And she's written a bunch of books, but she has a special on Netflix that came out probably a year ago now, and she talks about what happened when that YouTube video of her TED talk went viral and the comments, and then what happened with her and how she handled it and what she took from it. It's very interesting. You know, her thing is, do you know the Theodore Roosevelt quote about being in the ring and daring greatly? If I'm going to fail, I'm going to fail having dared greatly. I'm butchering it, but that's the concept. And she wrote a book called Daring Greatly. But the, you know, her observation was, and kind of how she decided to deal with that stuff going forward is, you know, here she had this TED talk with millions of views on YouTube, like overnight blew up.
Oh my.
Then people are commenting on her appearance and telling her she needs to do this or do that. You know, I mean, just being really nasty. And she basically like hit it home for a few days and then, you know, kind of coached herself out of it. And what she arrived at is, you know, I'm in the arena fighting the fight. And these are spectators. So, you know, people who aren't willing to dare greatly, people who aren't willing to be in the arena, I have no time for what. They're not even willing to be in the fight. Why would I let the spectator's observation affect me and how I feel? So, yeah, it's a great... Her work is incredible. Brene Brown, Brené Brown. You'd love it.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to.
She's
I'm
all,
definitely.
Yeah.
Going
she's like, she's one of my heroes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm already feeling like she's heroic. So,
absolutely. She's heroic. She's heroic. Lately, she posted something online not long ago about, people telling her to just shut up and be a therapist, basically, and quit talking about politics. And you know, I mean, her response was basically, you know, and all these people were telling her, you know, I'm not going to follow you anymore. I'm done following you. I'm not reading your books anymore, you know, and going out with two middle fingers raised to her, you know?
Wow. Yeah.
And her response was basically, I see you. Like, It's okay. Mm-hmm. You don't have to say goodbye. It's weird, first of all, that you're doing that. But also, like, this isn't about politics. This is about kindness and love. And because that's what really bothers me about everything that's going on politically. I mean, whether or not you believe that Donald Trump's policies, whether they be about the economy or whatever else, whether or not you agree with any of it, he treats people like garbage. He treats people like garbage. And the only people who do that are people who hate themselves. That's really, and we just deserve better than that.
Yeah.
I think, and it's, I don't know, I have my ideas about where this originates from, but, you know, collectively as a society, we're pretty unhealed. And it's not a healthy response to have so many of us cheer on a guy who, you know, treats women poorly, talks down to reporters. Yeah, I mean, the list goes on and on about the despicable things he does. You know, we're not even getting into the cages. And I mean, it's just one thing after another. But yeah, no, he's not nice. You know, that's to me is as bad as anything else. Like, why would we want someone who treats people that way to be our leader? You know, it's just crazy. It's crazy. And so how are you feeling about this election?
Oh my. Well, recently there was an exhibition in St. Petersburg, Florida, where I was invited to produce two pieces of work that are unbiased, so to speak, and promoting this idea of voting, exercising your right to vote. And I kind of struggled a little bit to make the work. One, just because of the personal life chaos, but also kind of trying my best to stay in the middle.
Okay, which can be pretty tough.
Yeah, and I made a blue piece and a red piece, but I also had them intertwine in color. I didn't want them to be solely one or the other. Like, I wanted it to be both. And I put a lot of stars and such for, like, patriotism and glitter, because I just like things that are shiny, and I feel like other people do too. And I made a figure for each piece. And I made the blue one first, because I felt most compelled to make that one first. and I loved it. Like, I was like, oh, this is perfect. I'm so happy with it. How do I make the next one? Mm-hmm. And I just start, and I think of them as like, as a diptych. They can be together or they can be separate, but I think together they really make strong statement. And I did something subtle, which wasn't intentional. I only realized it after the fact. And in one of the eyes of the other figure, the red figure, I created like kind of this dark eye. And I've done it in the past with other works. So, I mean, aesthetically and going with kind of kimo kawaii culture in Japanese culture. So, like, ugly cute or scary cute, like, kind of going with that. And it just happened. But I put them next to each other, and I was like, maybe there's something subliminal here. It certainly wasn't intentional, but it did come out somehow different. And I felt like I said what I needed to say without saying it verbally.
So tell me about the pilot pin thing. What happened with that?
Oh my goodness. So, back in 2018, I had my first solo exhibition. I was invited by, a gallery owners of an entity called Space 42, and they are located here in Jacksonville. And, the way that we got connected was, they saw a piece of my artwork on my social media, and they privately inquired if it was available, and it was. And so I brought it to them in person, and they purchased the work. But as I brought it, I didn't really have anything to carry it in other than like, kind of like a portfolio book with like, pages that are, archival. And, cause I mean, I had it left over from photography. So yeah. I just emptied all the photos and put in like whatever works I had to keep them safe. And they loved it, and they ended up looking at more works in there and bought a few more and said, what do you plan on doing? You know, what do you plan on doing with these works? And I said, well, I don't know, you know, someone who owns a coffee shop here, they asked me if I'd be interested in putting work in there. And I entertaining the idea, and they said, well, why don't you just have a solo show here? And I said, because this is a 26,000 square foot warehouse, that feels like a bit of a jump for me, and right. I've only begun, you know, like right. It feels very like daunting. And they said, no, I think it's going to be great. And so we set a date for a year after that point, which was September 2018. So I met them in 2017 when I really first started full-time artist. And I worked toward that point and had some interesting group exhibitions along the way prior to it. And someone who was working in PR, not for my show, but for a show previous to mine, came to the exhibition. And they brought someone with them whom they were working with in PR for Pilot Pen. And Pilot Pen is a Japanese company, but their U.S. headquarters is here in Jacksonville, Florida. And I didn't know. Like, I just didn't. I didn't know. And so it was kind of a chaotic ride the evening of. And I met this person at that is affiliated with Pilot Pen, and they loved my work. You know, wow, I love your work, especially these more like watercolor based with ink. And I said, oh yeah, that makes sense because you work at Pilot Pen, you know, you know, I don't know if that came off strange, but probably I said something like that. And then they followed up. And they said, we're coming out with this new line of artistic materials for Pilot Pen. And we're interested in you creating works with those materials. And I said, okay. Like, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say no, but also like... I mean, I never done anything like that before, so I don't know what to expect or what you expect from me. But if you have some things you want to lay out, I can, you know, do my best. And they were great, you know, like they sent me all the materials and I could try a little bit here and there. And there was kind of a very loose deadline, so it wasn't like, oh, hurry up, get this done. But they were working in PR with a magazine based out of Chicago, which is called 66 Magazine. And I'd never heard of them, but I said, oh, that's great. You know, you're going to have like some kind of campaign to promote these materials in this magazine. And the magazine is distributed to like art fairs and other like architectural and all kinds of different forms of creativity. And so I met the deadline, and along the way, I was like, hey, what do you think about this? You know, like send a picture. And mm-hmm. then they're like, oh my gosh, we love it. And then I'm like, okay, because maybe I had an idea of what I wanted to do, but after I started working with the materials, my ideas changed,
right.
You know, because I became inspired by like the colors of the materials and the way that Pilot Pen named some of their fluid inks, for example. It would be like Momiji, and Momiji is like a color of leaves in the fall. And so I allowed like those colors to inform my visualization of the work. And it was like, it was like a dream. They were so sweet to me. And I had an exhibition with the works with their permission because I didn't know what to do with them outside of the magazine. You know, I said, well, maybe I'll have an exhibition because I created a fair amount of pieces. And so I had an exhibition at a local ramen shop called Crane Ramen. And Pilot Pen ended up buying, I think, maybe four or five of those pieces for their corporate collection. And I mean, I went to deliver the work, and that day, like a Japanese person that's very high up in Pilot Pen was visiting that day. And I'm like so nervous, you know, like, oh my gosh, here's this thing. What if they don't like it? You know, like, I don't know. But everybody loved it. And I think it was one of my most favorite experiences I've had so far. Like,
It makes you happy just to talk about it.
Yeah.
So what's on the horizon?
Ahead. Well, I've had the opportunity to talk to you today, so that's lovely. Wow. It's not over yet. So technically, it's on the horizon.
Okay. Point well taken.
Let's see. Just yesterday, maybe day before yesterday, I had a Zoom call. You know, that is a way we are communicating often these days.
Yes,
and I had to do something new, which I hadn't done on a call, which is sharing your screen.
Yes. Yeah.
So I did that, and I was talking to a curator or three curators out of Tennessee, and I kind of submitted to a call to artists they had like maybe a month ago, and we had been kind of corresponding here and there in between, and they said, oh, we love your work, and we love to do a Zoom call with you when you have time. And I gave them some options, and they chose like the closest option available, you know.
we want to talk to you now.
Yeah, and I'm like feeling unprepared for that, you know. I thought maybe they're going to say in a week, but it was not. And it was fine. And I was expecting to speak to one curator, not three. So when I got on the call, I was like, oh, you know, like, hi. And it was a two-hour conversation. And they like deconstructed all of my work in my portfolio, and they gave me opportunity to kind of like speak about, you know, the intention behind work, the process behind the work, where I started, where the different bodies of work kind of transformed in the overarching body. And at the end, they said, we'd love to take 8 pieces here in Johnson City, Tennessee, for an upcoming exhibition called Welcome Home. It is her liminal Asian Appalachian experience exhibition. And And the other curator said, whatever they're not going to take, I'm going to take it to Kansas. And I said, okay. Wow. You know, like I think I'm still processing that information now, but looks like exhibition happens in January, both of them, one in Kansas and one in Tennessee.
So now what does that mean? So you submit the works, they're exhibited, and then does someone have the opportunity to purchase them? Or is that how, or do they send them back to you, or what happens?
Yeah, all the works are available for purchase if anyone might be interested. And I think in this particular case, I was very shocked because a normal protocol is artist would ship the work, and of course that is my cost, to ship it there and back if it does not go right to a forever home. But in this case, looks like it's the galleries are attached to educational institutions, which received grant funding to cover all the artist costs to send the work to and from. So, I mean, I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, that's great.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a work like that, what are you painting on?
Gosh, it's kind of transformed over the years, which is, you know, maybe each year I kind of evolve a little bit, and I only realized that in hindsight. But initially, the works were works on paper, and I was trying to say the most with the least amount of mark making. That was the approach that I was kind of taking. And then over the time, it became more of a layered process. And some of that was trial and error. You know, how do I make all of these components come together in a way that is also acknowledging longevity.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, maybe at first I was kind of dabbling with canvas and realized that, you know, it's still kind of a porous or breathable surface. So now it's more on like wood or gesso as the main substrate for the works that are formed on top of it. And so it is very much a collage or assemblage type process, which still lends itself to the illustration being the main focus of the work. Yeah, it's evolved over the time.
So, that's big, right? You're pretty excited about that. I can tell. Still processing it.
Yeah, I'm excited. I think next year, this year, a lot of things that were to happen either got postponed or canceled. So we're looking into the next year as new things arise and other things that were postponed are now coming to fruition with solidified dates. So next year, I'm also preparing for a solo exhibition at the Equestrian Center of America, Ocala. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So they're starting a new initiative called Art in City Spaces. And I'll be having works there in their city hall sometime between July and October of next year. And we kind of spoke a little bit about it earlier, about compassion and love and kindness. This new body of work I'm creating for that show is called Love Forever, paying kind of homage to Yayoi Kusama and how back in, you know, the 60s, 70s era, she was making a body of work, kind of a similar mindset, although the works themselves had different visual impact. So I do think that we are living in a time where more empathy and love could really spark togetherness or unity in our society and world. So that's kind of the concept behind the body of work that will go there in Ocala.
Well, you know, I really think that, and you're right, obviously, you know, I mean, if there's anything that can make anything better, it's love and empathy and more understanding. But I actually, I'm pretty hopeful, you know, when I see what's happening with younger people and, you know, I mean, in general, people are more empathic.
Yeah.
Overall. And it, to me, it feels like there's just still this subset of the population, mostly of a certain generation, that has a really hard time with all that.
Yeah.
And they're all walking around wearing red hats that say, you know, or a lot of them. And they're angry. And but not everybody's like that. I really think overall the trajectory is good, that that things are getting better. And I'm a big music fan. And there's this band Wilco that I like a lot. And they have a song. It's called You Never Know. But one of the lines in it is, every generation thinks it's the end of the world. I mean, you know, if you think about it, have you ever met a generation of people who didn't say kids these days or, you know?
No, I haven't.
I mean, now it's millennials that, that are getting, getting beat up on. And, you know, it's, yeah, but I think overall, I feel like we're getting better. We're growing emotionally and becoming kinder. And of course, there's still the ugliness there, but I don't know. I have to hold on to that. You know, I have to believe or else what's the point, you know? That's kind of where I'm at. Yeah. So, well, I could just go on and on talking to you forever, but it's been quite a while already.
It has.
So one of the things I ask of everyone is if there was a time in your life when the younger Elena needed to hear a word of advice, get some support, when would that have been most necessary and what would you go back and tell her?
I suppose the time in my life when I really needed to hear it the most was about 10 years old. And I would find that girl and I would reassure her that no matter what things may happen in life, to not lose sight of who you are and be unafraid to take risks and to use your voice. And to help others as much as possible. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Wow, that was great. That's like the essence of this podcast. I, you know, hopefully, I mean, that's what I'm kind of going for. But that was beautiful.
Oh, good. I mean, that's what I would say. So hopefully, I mean, I say it to myself now, but I think it's not just for me. It's for other people too, you know, to be in that space, mind space and and to take up space and but leave enough space for others, like I, you know.
Yeah, no, well, this has been great. I really appreciate it. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it too. I hope I didn't try.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. To Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.